Welcome back to another week at the Religious Studies Project. And here in Edinburgh, we are in a relaxed mood now that teaching has finally ground to a halt.
Oh yeah, we're in a relaxed mood,
yeah,
aren't we?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Other commitments can start back in earnest.
Indeed. But Religious Studies Project rolls on, and this week we have an interview with Tommy Coleman.
And with Will Gervais, and last week I called him Gervais, and then I listened to Tommy's interview and he said... It's Gervais, and made a point of that. So
here's Will Gervais on religion and theory of mind.
Thank you for joining us on the Religious Studies Project today. This is Thomas Coleman here, and we're happy to be sitting down with Dr. Will Gervais at the University of Kentucky with us to discuss what theory of mind and mentalizing is, and its role in both belief and non-belief in supernatural agents. And just a short background here, beginning in the mid-late 1990s, the notion of theory of mind or mentalizing began to draw great interest in a number of fields, specifically the cognoscience of religion. This capability has been invoked broadly in order to understand and explain not only belief in supernatural agents, but also the absence of such belief in these agents, and to more or less varying degrees of importance. So again, with us today, we have Dr. Will Gervais from the University of Kentucky. Dr. Gervais, welcome to the RSP.
Thanks for having me. It's great to get to chat with you.
Excellent. Starting off, obviously, you've published and have interests in a wide range of areas, I would say, and I was hoping for the listeners you might be able to give a summary of some of your research and also the cool things that are going on at the BAM lab at the University of Kentucky.
Yeah, thanks. That's BAM lab with three exclamation points.
BAM!
Yeah, so for the last... I don't know, a decade or so, I've been doing a lot of research where I try to hover between cultural psychology and evolutionary psychology, specifically looking at people's supernatural and religious beliefs. So trying to figure out what it is about the ways that the human mind works that makes religion such like a cross-culturally attractive concept for people. And then also trying to tease apart the different factors that lead to a lot of people, you know, by some estimates, nearly a billion people, to not harbor any religious beliefs whatsoever. So that's sort of the core of my research program, as well as looking at the consequences of either religious belief or religious disbelief for individuals, for societies. That research in general, it's taken us on quite a journey looking at topics from cognitive psychology, cultural psychology, developmental psychology. My nominal home base is in social psychology. I like to float around within psychology a fair bit. Currently, we have a lot of projects ongoing. So we're in the midst of a three-year Templeton-funded project just looking at some of the core cognitive, motivational, and cultural factors that predict religious disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
We have ongoing lines of research looking at people's perceptions of religious non-believers. So in a lot of countries around the world, probably most of them, atheists are not particularly popular people. And from a lot of the standard textbook social psych approaches to prejudice and stereotyping, this is a group that nobody should care about. And instead, we find that people care a whole lot in negative ways about them. So we're trying to figure out what's going on there.
I suppose just to dive straight into kind of theory of mind or mentalizing, or is it mind perception or social cognition? I know there's various labels that broadly fall into or can cover what we're talking about today. And what is theory of mind? What is mentalizing and mind perception? Are they similar? Are they different? And how do they relate to religion?
So I think at the broadest conceptual level, these terms such as theory of mind, mentalizing, mind perception, they're all referring to essentially the same kinds of things. So this is the ability to basically mentally represent what's going on inside other people's minds. So if I see somebody reaching for something, I might infer that they're reaching for that because they want it. They want to pick it up. They might want to use it because they have certain intentions that they want to enact upon the world. And for a lot of species out there, it seems like they're not very good at this kind of thing. They'll react to sort of immediately how other organisms are acting towards them, but it doesn't seem like they have this rich, deeper kind of a interpretation or representation of other beings' mental states. And within the field, yeah, like I said, some people will call it a theory of mind. Some people will call it mentalizing. Sometimes it just gets lumped together as mind perception. I think these are largely the same concepts. They have different intellectual histories where, for instance, the term theory of mind somewhat presupposes one view of developmental psychology where, you know, infants are forming and revising theories about the world. Whereas mentalizing, I think, is an attempt to be a bit more theory neutral. It's referring to the same thing without presupposing one theoretical approach to understanding the construct. In my research, I tend to use the term mentalizing because a lot of the journals have tight page and word limits, and theory of mind is three words. Mentalizing is one word, so it leaves me the freedom to keep working. On to the next part of that question of why it's important to the cognitive science of religion. Over the last couple decades, cognitive scientists of religion have kind of tried to map out what features of human psychology might enable religion to flourish, and also to try to figure out, given what we know about human psychology, what types of religious concepts would we expect to be culturally recurring. And theory of mind seems like a good place to start, because if you look at religious beliefs around the world, they tend to center on people's beliefs about supernatural agents. So these are intentional beings that have their own wants and desires, and they might get angry if I act in one way, whereas they're happy if I act in another way, or I can appeal to them to help me out. So people tend to think about their gods as intentional agents. So if we were to try to pinpoint one psychological or cognitive faculty that lets us work with other agents, it'd be theory of mind. So if we're thinking of the Abrahamic God is a disembodied kind of spiritual force with mental states. Basically, it's just mental states. So it would make sense that it's theory of mind or mentalizing that seems to be the core cognitive faculty that would be in play.
What are some of the ways that theory of mind is measured? Because obviously we're more or less talking about something that can't really be seen. I see some of your behavior, but I don't know that you want to reach for that cup, or for what purpose you're reaching for a cup or anything else. How do we measure theory of mind?
Yeah, this raises its own set of challenges. So theory of mind, throughout the development of the study of theory of mind, typically the types of tasks that people would use to measure it were done in a developmental psychology context where we know that, say, infants, they're not particularly good at this, whereas adults seem to be pretty good. So most of the tasks were designed to basically see where along that continuum people were. So unfortunately, this means that a lot of the theory of mind tasks out there are far too easy to use on adults to try to tease apart subtle differences. The tasks were designed to say, like, okay, this three-year-old, do they get it at this level or do they not get it at this level? Whereas in most of my research with mentalizing, I've been interested in these really subtle variations in advanced mentalizing abilities, and measurement at that level can be very complicated. So there are a couple of self-report questionnaires out there, so building on work by Simon Baron Cohen, where essentially you're asking people how good they are at putting themselves inside somebody else's head and interpreting their behavior. There are also some tasks that attempt to get at this in a more sort of performance-based way instead of self-report. So one task is called the reading the mind and the eyes task, where basically you give people a bunch of pictures of just a snapshot of kind of the area right around their eyes on their face. And you ask people to try to guess kind of what that person's going through, what they're experiencing, what are their emotional states. Neither of these measures are perfect, but hopefully they're bad in non-overlapping ways. So you kind of try to triangulate. Robin Dunbar and some of their colleagues have other kind of performance-based tasks where you're trying to map how many levels of intentionality people can represent. So for instance, if I'm representing one level of intentionality, that's me saying, okay, I want this. So want is one level. Whereas if I'm saying, okay, I know that Tommy wants to turn on that lamp. Now that's two levels because I have my representation in Tommy's. If I think that your listeners understand that I know that Tommy wants to play with that lamp, now we're up to three levels. And if the listeners understood that sentence, then we're at four levels. So they have some tasks where you basically see how nested people can get with these kind of social relational ties.
Just to kind of insert here on the interesting example you were giving about you thinking about me, thinking about me, thinking about you, could this ever stop? Where does it end? Is it possible, in terms of theory of mind, to just continually be stuck in a circular position where, you know, I'm thinking about you, thinking about me, thinking about you, thinking?
Yeah, I think in principle, there'd be no limit to it. In practice, we seem to run up against some computational limits pretty quickly. So I don't remember the exact figure from Dunbar's work with that task, but I think most people's performance really starts to taper off pretty quickly once you get up to around 6-7 levels of intentionality. And what's interesting is individual differences in performance on that kind of a task. It predicts, for instance, the size of people's social networks. Mm-hmm. So if I'm better at tracking what Jim thinks about Billy, thinks about Jane, thinks about Johnny, I'm more likely to be kind of nested within a larger social structure rather than, you know, if I have a hard time figuring what you might think of my best friend, I'm not going to hang out with that many people.
Obviously, this theory of mind capability appears to be certainly something we all share, more or less, and something that I guess could not develop on one's own. If I never had knew my mother, father, or many friends, then how would I, where would I be left with in terms of a theory of mind if it weren't for other minds?
Well, yeah, from an evolutionary perspective, this is definitely a cognitive faculty that we would never expect to find in kind of solitary living species.
Regarding mind perception, and I noticed, I think you have an article specifically on mind perception about, I think it was 2013, and I was wondering if you could go over what kinds of phenomena trigger mind perception. I think you have a mind, but as I understand, people also give minds to things that perhaps don't or shouldn't have them.
Yeah, mind perception is an interesting one. So it seems to be sort of an umbrella term that can encompass both what we were just talking about with mentalizing, but then also how we react when we feel like we're targets of another mind's attention. So within social psychology, I mean, really the development of the entire field of social psychology came about from asking questions such as, how do people behave differently if they feel like other people are watching them? Or, you know, if they're around other people. So fundamentally, these are questions about what happens when we perceive other minds in our world, especially other minds that are turning their attention to us. So some of the classic work on, say, social facilitation, it seemed like in some circumstances, people would get better at a task when there was an audience present. But on other types of tasks, people's performance would get much worse when there is an audience present. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of work looking at that. So essentially, mind perception can get triggered anytime people feel like there are other minds around, and especially other minds paying attention to one's own mind.
Are there any types of objects that we just kind of feel compelled to, see a mind in, even though clearly there's not?
It seems like, yeah, any sort of an object that has the configuration of, you know, two dots inside of a circle and then sort of a straight line below that. So something that looks like it might be a face. People have a hard time not seeing faces in these kinds of objects. So you can look on websites online and find people taking pictures of, you know, burn stains in toast or water stains on their wall or, you know, electrical outlets and trying to picture faces in these inanimate objects. So that seems to be a fairly low-level form of this kind of mind perception gone astray.
That certainly ties in with a previous podcast where we've had Dr. Guthrie's anthropomorphism and the faces in the clouds. So perhaps in straying a little bit here, how do the two link up, anthropomorphism and mind perception and cognitive science of religion?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So there are a couple different takes on anthropomorphism. So one of them is this idea of overactive agency detection. So this is the notion that we might be tripwired to detect agency out in the world, to the point where we overperceive it. So we see faces in the clouds, we see Jesus in toast. Another perspective from kind of a distinct social and cognitive psychology perspective would be that it's not necessarily about over detecting agency out in the world, but rather over attributing agency to things that are not agents. So this would be work by folks like Nick Epley, Adam Waits, Kurt Gray does some of this work as well, where, for instance, in certain situations, we might be just simply more motivated to treat non-agents as if they were agents. So as a classic example, you know, you're trying to type a paper late at night, and all of a sudden your computer crashes. You didn't save it. You don't say, oh, wow, what an unfortunate chain of electrochemical events inside of my computer. You say, oh, stupid computer, why do you hate me? So now you're attributing agentic qualities to essentially, you know, a pile of minerals. So that it's a bit of a subtle distinction. I think in terms of the research, we're a long ways from teasing apart sort of how much of it is over detection and how much of it is over application.
I can even just think of, you know, thinking my computer or the recorder messing up and say, man, this thing's just lost its mind. Yes. You know, implying that in the first case, it had a mind to lose, and now that it's behaving strangely, it's gone.
Well, yeah, once it behaves unpredictably, you both grant it a mind and then assume that somehow that mind has gone wandering away.
Now, at this point, we've touched briefly on kind of a theory of mind's relationship and role in the cognitive science of religion, and I would think that as far as my reading and studies have gone, that there's a lot of explanatory weight placed on theory of mind and mentalizing in cognitive science of religion. Is this theory of mind or this ability some type of a religious specific system? What kind of role does it really go towards in explaining belief or non-belief?
Yeah, this is a really complicated question that it seems like the field has been grappling with for a couple of decades. To start with the question of, you know, is theory of mind, say, a religious cognitive faculty? That one I'd say we can say fairly convincingly that the answer is no. We evolved theory of mind for dealing with other humans, essentially. Mm-hmm. But once we have theory of mind, man, it's a great candidate for something that successful religions will be able to recruit. So those religions that have caught on and stuck around, they're really good at tripping people's existing mentalizing faculties. So in terms of how much explanatory weight we have, I think we could say that theory of mind and mentalizing, they do a great job of explaining why human religion looks the way it does. So this could be why, you know, religions tend to focus on concepts of intentional supernatural agents rather than more abstract forces or, you know, non-agentic sacred rocks. Those tend to not be successful religions unless, you know, this rock is sacred because it's the home of some ancestor spirit who is that intentional agent you can work with. So I think you could say that, you know, if people didn't have theory of mind, then potentially we wouldn't have religion, and certainly we wouldn't have religion that looks anything like any of the religions that have been successful throughout human history.
And I suppose, of course, theory of mind could possibly and potentially be used to explain things that we wouldn't at all consider religious. If it's an ability that underlies many things, then it should it underlie other things besides religion? I don't, whether it's, you know, participating in sports or music or enjoyment in those areas?
Well, there's some really interesting work and theory looking at, you know, the question of does theory of mind get us religious belief, or does it just help shape the concepts that then become candidates for, say, cultural processes to get people to believe in? Mm-hmm. So, for instance, a lot of the theorizing about why theory of mind would be important for religion also predicts that theory of mind would be really important for predicting what are successful folk tales. So, you know, for instance, looking at which of the stories by the Brothers Grimm catches on and which ones we've never heard of. It seems like, yeah, successful folk tales, successful urban legends, even ones that are able to trip theory of mind in the right ways, these ones will be successful even if nobody believes in them. You can even look at cartoon characters. So for a long time in cognitive science and religion, people have talked about the Mickey Mouse problem. So in terms of cognitive content, Mickey Mouse and, you know, a lot of successful gods like Zeus or Yahweh, they're kind of similar. Lots of people believe in the latter two. Nobody believes in Mickey Mouse. So it seems like it can't just be the ability to trip theory of mind that's explaining why people would actually believe in them.
And just to insert kind of a fun fact here, I think that your colleague Ara Noren Zion, who you've also been heavily involved with and done some good work, he uses the example of why people haven't heard of donkey lettuce. That is a fairy tale, and I'm sure everyone listening right now is going to say, what in the world? And I don't know much about it, but I would encourage anyone listening to check out donkey lettuce.
Yeah, that was a fun paper that I think that was Ara and Jay Faulkner and Mark Schaller, where they looked at kind of this idea of, you know, from cognitive science and religion that we might have these templates where, you know, we like characters that are just a little bit counterintuitive. So we can apply most of what we know about certain types of agents and objects in the world. But if we tweak the content a little bit, now they're interesting and memorable. So they applied this idea to fairy tales, and yeah, they were able to somewhat explain which fairy tales we've heard of and which ones sucked and nobody wants to read children.
Yes, donkey lettuce won't be on my daughter's reading list anytime soon.
Now you've got me intrigued, though. I want to check it out.
I was wondering, bringing closer to the end here, if you could discuss some of the growing theorization that supports a relationship of varying degrees between what is known as the broader autism phenotype and theory of mind with belief and non-belief. You mentioned some of Baron Cohen's work earlier. How do these link up and where do you weigh in?
Yeah, so if we're looking at sort of the constellation of different issues that are involved with autism spectrum conditions, it seems like one recurring idea is that one thing that's going on with autism is that these folks, you know, especially with high functioning autism, they can be super high in intelligence, really good at, for instance, reasoning about mechanical or logical systems, but they're just not quite as adept with advanced theory of mind. So if we think of some of the theoretical work with cognitive science and religion, where we're pinpointing theory of mind as potentially a good candidate for the foundational cognitive construct underlying the ability to mentally represent personal supernatural agents, then you'd be able to predict that people who have a bit of a more challenging time with advanced mentalizing, they might not be able, or they might have a more challenging time adopting beliefs in kind of personal anthropomorphic supernatural agents. With Ara and some other colleagues a few years back, we actually ran some studies to try to test this idea. So we had one study where we recruited some clinically diagnosed autistic participants and then some matched controls. And actually, Ara and I totally piggybacked on this study. We had a colleague who was running such a study, and we said, hey, can we plug in some religion items?
As any good psychologist should.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely try to have other people do the work as much as you can. And so in that initial study, it turned out that, at least in our study, I mean, there were issues in the study. It was a small, very small sample study. All the participants were from, I want to say, somewhere in Florida. So they're coming from a religious context where they're getting these, you know, this barrage of cultural cues that religion is something you should be into. But at least in that study, it looked like our clinically diagnosed autistic participants were quite a bit less likely to strongly endorse kind of a personal god. And then we wanted to follow up on this because autism isn't just sort of a binary clinical diagnosis. It exists along a spectrum. And so in Simon Baron Cohen's work, he'd argue that we could put everyone somewhere on the spectrum from not the least bit autistic to clinically diagnosed, but people will fall somewhere in between. So we were interested in looking at whether, if we just look at where, you know, in a non-clinical population, do people who score higher on a measure of the autism spectrum, do they tend to also report lower levels of belief in God? So we had three studies. So I think one of them was Canadian undergrads, one of them was Mechanical Turk, and then one of them we tried to get a nationally representative sample in the U.S. And indeed, that's what we found consistently. So people who score higher on an autism spectrum questionnaire report lower levels of belief in God. And then we also had some of these, you know, variously crappy theory of mind measures thrown in there. And it seemed like people's performance on the theory of mind measures was explaining that relationship between autism spectrum and belief in God. Interestingly, some of this research also potentially has some bearing on a long recognized gender gap in religiosity. So if you look in the sociology of religion, sometimes they call this the cardinal rule of the sociology of religion, is that women tend to be more religious than men. And this seems to show up across a fair number of cultures. It's not, you know, an ironclad universal, as these things never are. But typically, if you get a big enough sample of people, the women are going to look slightly more religious than men. And what's interesting is you also get a gender difference in advanced mentalizing abilities. So women tend to be a bit better at advanced mentalizing than our men. So across those three latter studies, the Canadian undergrad one and then the two broad American samples, we found that these subtle differences in advanced mentalizing also explain the gender gap in religious belief. So the story goes that women are a bit better at mentalizing, and that's potentially one key reason why they're more religious than men on average.
To wrap up here, I was wondering, just kind of have an open question for you to bring our listeners home. And in your opinion, what is the most important point for our listeners to remember when they're reading an article or having a conversation about the role of theory of mind in belief and non-belief? What are some take-home points on theory of mind?
I'd say the take-home points, I can come up with a couple of them. So one would be to really pay attention to the effect size rather than just the existence of an effect. So all of those effects that I was just mentioning between autism spectrum and religious belief, they are tiny. So we're explaining almost none of the variability among individuals in religious belief. And a lot of that is because if you look at the theory, we're saying that pretty much everybody is pretty good at theory of mind. And then the cognitive science of religion, we're saying, well, as long as your theory of mind is good enough, you'll have no problem mentally representing supernatural agents. So this kind of leads to the prediction that adequate theory of mind is kind of a necessary but not sufficient explanation for supernatural beliefs. So we'd fully expect that theory of mind isn't going to have a great impact on religiosity, unless you're looking at people who are really starting to perform poorly on advanced theory of mind tasks. And then the other key point is keeping track of sort of the hypothesized direction of causation here. We're saying that you need theory of mind to have beliefs in a personal God. So we predict that people who are a bit lower on theory of mind are going to be a bit less likely to have strong religious beliefs. But oftentimes people will flip this and they'll think that the claim is that atheists must therefore all be autistic, which is committing like three or four logical and statistical no-nos. But yeah, when we published that research, I know at least one blog ran with the headline of "Atheists lack empathy and understanding for others," which, mind-boggling.
is there anything else like to add to that? And we'll wrap up on theory of mind.
Cool. Now that about covers my opinions on the topic.
Well, Dr. Will Gervais, thank you very much for joining us on the Religious Studies Project today. And is there a website that perhaps our listeners can go to and check out some of your work?
I reckon the best place to find me is willgervais.com.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Religious Studies Project.
You know, David, we didn't actually say who we were at the start of that interview, but all of our all our interviewers, listeners will know that, of course. You're David Robertson.
And you're Christopher Cotter.
And we are presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. So theory of mind, that's something that's come up before on the RS project. Not so explicitly, but we actually had the great Anne Taves wrote a piece on theory of mind for us a few months ago. So do check that out. I'll try and make sure when I write the page for this podcast that I have already written, because you're listening to it, that I put a little link into that. March was our busiest month yet.
That's astounding. What were the numbers again?
Well, I think this is hits. We had something like 14,500 hits on the website. I think Daniel clarified that we had around 7,000 unique visitors to the website.
So that's for 1 month. Yeah. Last month, 7,000 unique visitors.
Which I'll take.
That's good. Yeah, that. That's all right.
So thank you to
our Facebook page is creeping towards
2,500
followers. We might even be there by the time this goes out.
Absolutely. So we're very, very grateful.
We are very grateful indeed. And humbled to be able to, be involved with such a lively community.
Absolutely.
Come back on Thursday, for our response to this interview by Hugh Turpin from Queen's Institute of Cognition and Culture.
But and next week we've got an interview that we're pretty excited about. We don't really go in for too much of the celeb worship on the RS project, but we've got a proper religious studies celebrity next week.
Indeed.
That's Brad Stoddard.
And he is speaking to someone called Bruce Lincoln. So I'm sure that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of an overview of the critical study of religion and Bruce Lincoln's career more largely and his recent work specifically. So that's a great interview. A very lively interview, shall we say.
It's going to be brilliant.
So yeah, you're going to enjoy that.
Just, the usual. We've mentioned our social media feeds, Facebook, Twitter. Remember the iTunes, and of course our Amazon links. As ever, they do keep ticking over, and it's all thanks to you. But if you've not used one of them yet, think about it. Or if there's another online sort of avenue that we should be exploring, if you're really anti-Amazon or something, I don't know why you would be, but let us know.
Yeah, but for now, thanks for listening.
Booyah!